Doubt is eliminated through action, but it's the type of action that is important.
Hey folks, this is Mark Devine with the Unbeatable Mind Podcast. Thanks for joining me today. Super stoked to have you on board. And we are going to have a terrific conversation with Mr. Dr. Sid Ellington, who's a good friend of mine, actually, a teammate from way back when at SEAL Team 3. But before I introduce Sid a little bit more in depth, once again, thanks for supporting the Unbeatable Mind Podcast. It really helps if you rate the podcast so others can find it. We have over 1,000 five-star ratings on iTunes. But wherever you listen, helpful to rate it or share it with your friends. Just let them know that you hear some really interesting things here, and that's helpful. Also, if you like to watch the podcast, even though it's just a couple of people jawboning back and forth on a video at this point in time, we do have these on our YouTube channel, so Unbeatable Mind YouTube or Mark Devine YouTube, and you can find them at our website, unbeatablemind.com. All right. So, Sid, I'm super stoked to have you here. I've got Navy SEAL, retired commander, Sid Ellington. Spent 21 years in the Navy. Started out, interestingly enough, as a surface warfare officer, a boat driver, and then transitioned over to the SEALs. Many folks don't realize that a lot of officers in the Naval Special Warfare community actually come from surface warfare or even the air community. I remember a bunch of pilots who had transitioned over. It's pretty cool. After retiring, Sid went on and got his PhD and then served as executive director of the Warrior School Project, which is a nonprofit providing educational services for military vets transitioning so they can get their college degrees. He also serves as a teacher in New Orleans in the Teach for America program and is director of veterans outreach in support of that Teach for America. He planned and spearheaded the Louisiana Department of Education's citywide truancy reduction program for New Orleans. I think, Sid, you're a powerful example of how veterans can continue to serve our country through a multitude of ways, but particularly through education and nonprofit initiatives. Most people think of, especially transitioning SEALs, as like picking up weapons and going and working for Blackwater or coming and working for SEALFIT. But you've charted a different path. And so I appreciate that. And then also, I will say, full disclosure, that I'm excited to have Sid join our Courage Foundation recently as executive director. So a huge boost for our leadership there. Sid, thanks for joining me today. I really appreciate your time and your service. So hoo-yah.
Hey, thanks for having me. Just like to send a shout out real quick and prayers and thoughts for all the families that have been impacted by Hurricane Ida. You know, that's Louisiana and the Mississippi Gulf Coast. Those folks down there are dealing with a lot. And so,
I was thinking about that in terms of people who lived through Katrina now experiencing that. That must have brought up some serious post-traumatic stress issues or a lot of fear. And, hopefully I'm certain they're much more prepared, both in terms of resiliency, but also in terms of the actual infrastructure. But what's your take on like the resilience and infrastructure and how people can handle this versus Katrina?
Well, I think the city as a whole is better able to handle it. You know, they've reinforced the levees. Corps of Engineers has done that. And so you didn't have flooding at all in New Orleans.
Oh, good.
It's the outlying areas. You know, the water's got to go somewhere when you have that kind of storm surge. So folks like in Houma and Laplace, there's a lot of devastation, you know, up there as well. Yeah, so, you know, what I experienced, in my time with Teach for America, teaching in New Orleans, big rainstorm, you see kids really freaking out. There's definitely some scars from Katrina.
Hmm. Yeah. And it's just, you know, for someone like me who hasn't lived through a devastating event like that, where you're literally, your house gets completely swamped or ruined by mud or you know, burned by a fire or blown away in a tornado, just the recovery has got to be torturous. You know what I mean? When everything's stripped away from you and you've got to start over like that.
Yeah, I can remember, everybody remembers Hurricane Katrina in the Lower Ninth Ward, driving through 5 years after Katrina, and the Lower Ninth Ward was still nowhere near a level of recovery that you would expect. You know, over a 5-year period, it was just devastated.
That's amazing. Well, yeah, we'll send our healing energy to that area and anyone else suffering right now. We have, fires in California. And we've got this crazy situation in Afghanistan, which I want to come back to and talk about it through the lens of veterans. But let's kind of back up in time a little bit. You're from Oklahoma.
I am.
What is an Oklahoma boy doing in the Navy? And, you know, there's not a lot of water around there.
You know,
how did you get to go to the Navy surface warfare? And then, you know, what?
Yeah. So you and I are about the same age. And I grew up thinking that my trajectory was, I was going to go into the Army and go to Vietnam. And, Saigon fell when I was in junior high school, and suddenly I didn't have a plan anymore. So, I just, as you get older and you read, I read They Were Expendable by William White, and thought PT boats were awesome, and decided I wanted to join the Navy. And so,
did you have military in your family?
Pardon?
Was your family a military family?
Yeah, my dad was in the Army Cavalry in World War II.
No kidding.
No kidding. Yeah, so he fought in the Pacific.
Did he actually
never talk about it?
Did he have a horse, or did they move down the horses by then?
They used horses, and part of his role as a young enlisted guy was he took care of the horses. But they didn't have mechanized, completely, mechanized equipment pullers. so they did use horses, and that was part of his job, was to take care of the horses.
That's incredible. You know, that was literally only 80 years ago?
Something like, yeah. Yeah.
Amazing. Okay, so you found yourself. Did you go? So you went to Oklahoma State, right?
University of Oklahoma.
So you got your college degree there. Did they have an ROTC program, or how did you?
They did. And back in those days, I being an Oklahoma boy from farm country, sitting in the armory there, my first ROTC class, just kind of an introductory. What do you want to do? Why are you in the Navy? And, I want to go on a Spruance class destroyer. I want to fly F-14s. And these kids had all this technical knowledge. And when it came to my turn, Instructor Shaughnessy, Lieutenant Shaughnessy said, and Midshipman Ellington, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I'd like to command a squad of PT boats. And the room erupted into laughter. And I didn't know why. And he says, well, I got to break it to you. There haven't been any PT boats in the inventory in a while since the Korean War. So I had to come up with another plan. And that plan was to go through BUDS training. But, back then in the 80s, going straight from ROTC to BUDS, there were four or five billets for the entire country. So The path was, you go get your surface warfare, your warfare pen, and then apply. And so that's the route I followed. So I went to, got orders to BUDS as a JG.
That's interesting. But you didn't have any guarantee. You had to go through surface warfare school. You had to get qualified as a surface or a SWO officer to earn your SWO pin. And then you had to apply to BUDS, right? It's not like you had some kind of guarantee.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And then I had to apply.
Well, it's interesting. So you probably went into the Navy around 86 or 87?
85 is year group 85.
85. So I graduated college 85. I was a few years behind you. I went to SEAL training in late 89. No, I went to OCS late 89, November of 89, and then into BUDS in 90. But I was, I had a similar situation, but it was even worse. There were only literally two that they took from OCS the year I applied.
Oh, wow.
And so I went Officer Candidate. I didn't have an ROTC program at Colgate or NYU, nor was I even thinking about it. But that's curious. When you were talking about that, I was thinking to myself, SEALs or bust. Like, they didn't offer me, maybe you should go surface warfare, and then if you really want to be a SEAL, you can apply later on. I was like, I want to get a billet with a guarantee to be, to go to SEAL training after Officer Candidate School. And they had two of them in that regard that they gave out that year, and I got one. But if I didn't get that, I'm really curious what I would have done, whether I would have backtracked and said, okay, I'll go SWO and then apply.
Yeah, it's for me it was surface. ROTC was set up for surface aviation and submarines. Right. So those were your three pipelines.
Right.
We would have a few that went into the Supply Corps, but not many. It was mostly those three warfare specialties is what ROTC was structured around.
Right.
You know, at least back in those days.
So let's, it's always fun when I talk to SEAL teammates to get a glimpse of their SEAL training, of buds, and, you know, what were the highs and lows and crazy things or leadership lessons, you know, one or two. Don't, you know, we don't want to spend all day. But then, you know, let's talk about your operating career and then your administrative career. Let's you know, kind of peel back the onion on what it was like to be a Navy SEAL for Commander Sid Ellington and Ensign Lieutenant J.G. Ellington, you know. Lieutenant Commander Ellington.
Yeah, my first, you know, my first thoughts, you know, being out on the grinder for the first time, you know, I was a little bit older. You know, everybody else in the class was an ensign. Most of them, you know, had come from the Naval Academy.
The other officers, you mean?
The other officers. Yeah. Yeah.
Most of the class were enlisted.
Thanks for the correction. Yeah. We started with 105 and wound up graduating 17 originals.
That's a pretty small class actually to start.
Yeah.
We had 185 and we graduated 19.
Wow. They're going to get the numbers down below 20 somehow.
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah. But I can remember looking left and looking right. And some of these guys were just massive. And, you know, here I am 5'6". And I think at the time I might've weighed 135 pounds. And I'm like, I'm with the wrong group of people. But, you know, the other thing I noticed is as training got started, some of those great big guys with all the muscles were the first ones to quit.
Right.
Maybe it's because they'd never done anything hard before.
Well, I think that's really interesting point, and that is surprising for a lot of people to hear, but that was my experience as well. And it's our experience also with SEALFIT. And I know you've experienced coaching a SEALFIT event. The more muscle mass you have, unless it's trained properly, right? If you've trained muscle mass through like hypertrophy, which is like bodybuilding, it does not serve you well in a training situation like, you know, like buds. And those people end up getting rhabdomyolysis and, you know, really just burning out. They don't have the muscular stamina. So you got to have the right type of muscles if you're going to have muscles. And you don't have to be a big burly dude. Like you said, you were part of one of those smaller guys and some of the, you know, the shorter guys were some of the best performers in my class, right? And of course, we anecdotally called them the Smurf crew, which I'm not sure would pass today's muster, but it was, they all took it in stride.
I was definitely in the Smurf crew and got full benefit for being in the Smurf crew.
Right. So tell us about your ups and downs and buds. What were some of the biggest ahas and interesting leadership lessons?
Well, the great thing about buds is, you know, they'll get, you know, they'll find your weakness. And then those instructors will dig and dig and dig and probe and probe and probe. I was not, you know, real fast in the water. So I always struggled, you know, with the timed swims. I passed them all, but always just barely. I guess if the minimum passing time wasn't good enough, it wouldn't be the minimum. My strength was the O course, you know, did real well there. But, you know, Buds was a trial and, you know, just being pushed every single day. But following, you know, and seeing some of the, you know, best doggone leaders, you know, that I'd ever seen up until that point. Certainly didn't see them in the surface Navy. I remember when we were doing the underwater swim and some guys were struggling with it. And Ryan Zinke said, "Let me show you how this is done." Mm-hmm. And Ryan Zinke, of course, is a former congressman and secretary of the Interior. Mm-hmm. I think he's running for the Senate now.
I just saw him.
Sat
next to him on the plane out to Wyoming. He was heading back to Montana. Yeah, no, he's running for the new congressional seat that opened up for Montana after the new census. And he's recruited five or six other SEALs to run for different congressional seats because he's not happy with what he sees going on in the, you know, in the politics. So he's jumping back into the ring with a bunch of other guys. So it'll be interesting to see how fair next year.
Well, what I remember and the thing that made such an impression on me is, you know, he was on the edge of the pool and he did a complete front flip and landed into the water and then swam 50 meters and then, you know, climbed out and said, "That's how it's done." And, you know, that was when I saw, you know, for the first time stuff that, you know, you only read about in books and movies. And that is, you know, leadership by example. Didn't see that so much, you know, in the surface Navy as often. But that made a real impression on me that, you got to do it. You can't just, give the orders. And, all of our instructors and buds were just phenomenal people. Yeah. And, they didn't say go run, 4 miles. They would lead you in a 4 mile run. And, we also had a person from Bud's class 65 who had retired, and he did every open ocean swim with our class.
Really?
But there was a real, the leadership was more by, example. It was kind of the follow me mode, which really resonated with me as a young leader.
Right. No, I love that. That's kind of a hallmark of great leadership anywhere, but especially in the SEALs. So we kind of took it for granted.
Yeah.
Once we got kind of baked into that you had to lead by example, lead from the front, but doesn't mean you always have to take charge. You just have to demonstrate that you're willing to do the work. Right.
Yeah.
And you're willing to be competent at all the skills. Like the enlisted guys didn't expect us officers or cake eaters to be the best at everything, but they expected us to not slow the team down. Right. So we had to be out there doing the work
and be willing to pitch in and help. And let somebody else be in charge for any particular evolution where they hold the expertise, being confident enough to, to do that.
That's right. Interesting. So what was the biggest challenge for you in SEAL training?
I think probably once I got to SEAL Team 3, and that was before SQT and some of the stuff that we have in place now. So you were still in training. It was just advanced training as you, went through your pre-deployment training with your platoon. You weren't certified.
We didn't earn the Trident until 6 months after showing up at our SEAL team.
At least, yeah.
And we had to go through the whole PQS or personal qualification standards thing, all the interviews, learn all the advanced skills. So that was all replaced by what's now SQT. So currently BUDS is 9 months and you get your Trident when you're done. Back when you and I went through, BUDS was 6 months. Then we went to the team, we had 6 more months of training. And if you were ready, you got your Trident, but not all of us got our Tridents.
Not everybody. Yeah. Usually, the goal was to, get everybody qualified, all the new guys in a platoon before deployment date rolled around. And the guys that needed some more time and hadn't qualified yet and hadn't earned their Trident, they rolled into another platoon. But what I found that was most difficult for me was the underwater ship attacks, because I had been, a shipboard engineer and, had understood how easy it would be to send a new guy, down below decks to secure all the C suctions and have something missed.
So you mean water getting sucked into the boat?
Getting sucked in.
So a Navy SEAL underneath a boat wanders up against one of these things and gets sucked in.
And you get sucked right into the intake. And there's a screen there, of course, but for the pumps, you're not going to be able to get off of it because those pumps are really, really huge. And when
happened to a SEAL team guy?
Not to a SEAL team guy that I know of. The big story that they were telling was a platoon doing ditch and dawn, which is, where you take your dragger off and then you do a free ascent up the side of the ship. And what you're trained to do is find a welding seam and follow that welding seam up to the surface.
Right.
And
otherwise you don't really know what direction you're swimming because
you have no idea.
Pitch black. Yeah.
It's pitch black and you don't realize how huge the bottom of a ship is, even a smaller ship.
Right.
And there was one individual, it happened probably maybe less than a year before I got to SEAL Team 3. He followed the wrong seam. And so he was going along the hull, not toward the surface, but from bow to stern.
Right.
And, got, shot a water blackout and drowned, as a result of it. And so there was a lot more precautions put in place, but, the being underneath the ship just unnerved me. That was my Achilles heel. That was my fear.
God. You just brought up a memory of mine. Yeah, one of our biggest disasters when I was a platoon commander was a ship attack, ditch and don, or don and ditch, or whatever we called it. Same exact training evolution where, I don't know what you did, but we took limpet mine magnets.
Mm-hmm.
We would string a line between them, paracord between them. And then we used that to hook our rigs onto the bottom of the ship so we could return and grab them.
Yeah.
And the guy, and of course, the person on the left and the right flank who were bringing these magnets along had a pretty important job. And one, you know, the guy, I'll just call him Q, the guy in the right flank with us who had this job was a pretty senior enlisted, E6, been in the teams for a while. At any rate, so he goes to, apparently, you know, and I'm the officer, I ditch my rig and I hook it up. And of course, you're underwater, you're not giving instructions to anybody, right? You're just all praying that everyone's squared away and is going to make it to the surface at this point. So what happened to him is he goes and he lost his bearings. You know, he kind of got a little bit of underwater confusion, which is easy to do. And he didn't hook his lip and mine up very well because it didn't hook up. Like it literally just ended up sinking to the bottom of the ocean, which took all the dive rigs with it. And it also took Rob Lasky, our chief, because he was all tangled up in it.
Good night.
I know, exactly. So we get to the surface and immediately do a head count. I'm like, we're missing somebody. And this guy Q had no idea what he had done. He was clueless. And so we're like, holy shit, we're missing. So, you know, we call the stop this evolution and we start like free diving down at the bottom of the bay and it's like 50, 60 feet deep. And we're like, crap, we couldn't find him. And the you know, the clock is just ticking. Like 4 minutes go by and I'm thinking, man, I just killed Rob. Or at least, you know, I was in charge when Chief Lasky died. You know, how's that story going to go? And suddenly I'm just kind of like sitting there wondering what the hell to do next. And I see this hand break the surface and then Rob's head. And he's just like calmly blowing and going. And he gets to the surface. He goes, hey, Si, I'm fine. Don't worry about me.
I feel fine.
I feel fine. Exactly. Yeah. So the story, he was down at the bottom of the bay and he just calmly said, okay, you know, assess the situation. I'm down here. I got trapped in this tangled thing. So he found, you know, searched his body, decided what he needed to do, found his dive knife, started cutting himself out. And this guy had lungs of steel, obviously.
Oh, man.
Super calm. That's the power of the training, you know?
Yeah. You know, I think that brings to light the importance of pool comp, you know, right. Whereas, you know, you get tumbled about and they, you know, tie your regulator hose into knots and disorient you as much as possible. And you've got to unsort yourself
right
through all of this and then do a free ascent to the surface. So obviously,
and it takes minutes, you know, it took me about 6 minutes and you have to find a little bit of air coming out of the regulator, mm-hmm. you know, and they tie that master knot into it. I had to use my foot to try to pull it apart.
all you need is just a little bit of air. Yeah. Just
a little bit of air. And that gives you another 30 seconds and you get a little bit more air and you kind of, you know, get it into your mouth and swallow it into your lungs. That training, you're right. And it's a great metaphor is any type of training that can desensitize you to the fear that, you know, accrues from an unknown situation. Right. And so if you're going to dive, then it's really important for you to be in a controlled environment and to get confused underwater, mm-hmm. to understand, wait a minute, you know, if I just calm down and assess the situation, right. And make sure that I have a source of air, right. Then I can clear my mask. And then I can, you know, step one, step two, step three. But if you just think you're going to go dive and be a hero and you do a ship dive or, you know, something at night and you haven't desensitized and figured out what to do when shit goes wrong, that's where people get killed.
Yeah.
The SEALs, you know, they apply that principle in every single thing, parachute diving, demolition, shooting. Interesting.
I'm excited to have this episode sponsored by Four Sigmatic, a wellness company well known for its delicious mushroom coffee. Four Sigmatic's mushroom coffee is real, organic, fair trade, single origin Arabic coffee. It's got lion's mane mushroom for productivity and chaga mushroom for immune support. I've been starting my day with Four Sigmatic ground mushroom coffee with lion's mane instead of just having regular coffee. I love how it helps me focus so I can get more done. It really is amazing. I absolutely feel an uptick in my productivity every time I drink it. It helps me focus like nothing else. Mushroom coffee is also easier on my gut. Doesn't leave me with that jittery feeling or midday crash that coffee can. All Four Sigmatic products are organic, vegan, and gluten-free, which is a major plus for me. Every single batch is third-party lab tested to ensure its purity and safety. You know you're getting the highest quality coffee and mushrooms possible with Four Sigmatic. Now you're probably thinking, does this stuff taste like mushrooms? That was what I was thinking. I guarantee you it doesn't. It tastes just like the coffee you love. It brews dark and nutty, and it tastes great. Over 20,000 five-star reviews they have. Best of all, Four Sigmatic backs their products with 100% money-back guarantee. So we have worked out an exclusive offer with Four Sigmatic on their best-selling mushroom coffee. This is just for Unbeatable Mind listeners. You can get up to 40% off plus free shipping on their bundles. To claim it, you must go to foursigmatic.com/unbeatable. That's four, F-O-U-R, sigmatic, sigmatic.com/unbeatable. The offer is only for Unbeatable Mind listener, not available on their regular website. You get to save up to 40% and get free shipping. So check it out. Give it a try. Go to foursigmatic.com/unbeatable to fuel your productivity and creativity with their delicious mushroom coffee. Hoo-yah, Four Sigmatic. Okay, so you went to SEAL Team 3, is that right?
I did.
Your first tour, that's where I met you. You were there a few years before me. I think you were just finishing up a platoon commander tour.
So we'd just gotten back from Desert Shield, Desert Storm.
Did you work on, do the oil rigs, or what was your, tell us about Desert Storm.
Well, Desert Storm, we were assigned, we did an ARG platoon, which is the Amphibious Readiness Group. So we were attached to, you know, an amphibious squadron and embarked with Marines.
Right.
And our job was, the boat patrols and beach preparation. That's what we trained for before we went over. And the other big issue was under very shallow water, underwater mines. Mm-hmm. And so we spent a lot of time in Puerto Rico learning some state-of-the-art equipment for that era for finding and detecting bottom mines. So that's what we deployed to do. As it was, General Schwarzkopf decided to do an overland attack, and the amphibious group was used as a decoy. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you remember, Tommy Dietz.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, were you part of that?
I wasn't. No.
Yeah.
Tommy Dietz was on a sister ship. He was part of that ARG, I believe. But
that's a great story. So as I recall, and you can tell me if this is true or not, but they were commissioned with creating a diversionary tactic where, to make the Hussein's forces think that we were doing an amphibious landing at this particular site. And so the SEALs brought in a bunch of haversacks of C4, and the Navy ships bombarded the beach, and the SEALs blew shit up. But the interesting thing that I love about that, and I actually wrote a little bit about this, is the water was so hot, and there were a lot of sharks around, that they were like, we can't possibly swim in this C4. And so they sent a request back. One of the junior guys who was from SoCal was like, hey, let's use boogie boards. Mm-hmm. And so they sent a request back to HQ and said, hey, we need a bunch of blacked out boogie boards sent over. And some old enlisted Vietnam guy like blew his stack. He's like, what the bleep are those guys doing over there? We're supposed to be fighting an effing war, and they want boogie boards.
Yeah. Yeah, we actually deployed with boogie boards.
We did.
Okay, had them flat black and, had them in the Connex boxes to haul gear with.
To haul gear. That's brilliant.
Yeah.
So let's fast forward. UDT, the old UDT missions, some people think this kind of ho-hum. I did one of those ARGs, and it's really interesting and really important work, but it might be important now with, kind of us repositioning toward state-on-state type warfare. If we do amphibious landings again, like when I was at 3, I did one of those tours, two of my tours in the Far East. I'm sure you might have done it as well. Mm-hmm. And we used to do the reconnaissance of the beaches, for a landing in Korea, mm-hmm. Which was kind of important work. But so beyond that, what was your experience with the war on terror as a SEAL?
After 9/11?
Yeah,
I was in a twilight tour and had already put in a request to retire. So I did not deploy to Iraq or Afghanistan.
You didn't? Okay.
No. My twilight tour was a reserve management tour. My wife, while we were in Hawaii, she went to law school. And so, after some heartfelt conversations, it was time for me to transition out at 20 years, mm-hmm. take the retirement. And then it was her turn to, have a career.
Right.
She's done really well. She did 2 federal clerkships and is working for a major company here in Oklahoma City now as in-house counsel.
That's great. That's really balanced. I love to hear you say that. It's important to give the wives who serve the men, especially for a 20-year career.
Yeah.
Support them. So did you become like, do you have any kids? Or
we've got 2. And
Mr. Mom for a while?
I wasn't really Mr. Mom, but they were older. You know, she was the stay-at-home mom while I was playing Navy SEAL. And then, the older son had graduated from high school while Tony, was in law school. And then, we had the little one who was doing really, really well in sports. And it was important to not be moving so much. So
right.
during the time I was in the Navy, we moved 12 times.
Unbelievable.
And Tony never lets me forget that. But, did the reserve management tour and we stayed put. And he was able to start and finish at the same high school. And he went on to play college baseball. So that was the right move for him, for sure.
Before we get into kind of what happened after your military career, leading as an officer in the SEALs, and especially as you get more senior, is very different than, leading a boat crew at Buds. So what were some of the biggest challenges and insights from a leadership perspective or from a teaming perspective that you've kind of gleaned from your overarching SEAL career as an officer?
That's a really good question. And I think, the biggest, takeaway is in the surface Navy, the shipboard Navy, there is a very, very rigid, chain of command, very rigid. And while you listen to input from your senior enlisted, it's not a shared responsibility. And what I saw and what I learned in Naval Special Warfare, and this was a bit of a transition for me, is it's okay, if the enlisted guys call you LT, not okay aboard a ship, but it's okay to have much more of a camaraderie, much more of a friendship, much more of a bonding that's really kind of looked down upon, in the surface Navy, at least my experience. You've got the officer's wardroom, and you've got the enlisted mess decks where officers and enlisted take their meals. But, mm-hmm. In the SEAL teams, everybody's breaking an MRE and, you share meals together. You mm-hmm. spend time together. You go on liberty together. And it's a much tighter knit group. And I just relished in it. And I really, really enjoyed it. But, trusting, your enlisted folks, knowing that they've got your back, and having the confidence, to turn the leadership over or turn the decision over if the situation warrants it. Mm-hmm. The buck stops with the officer, no doubt. Praise, you share praise downward mm-hmm. and responsibility for when things go wrong upward. And I think that's a leadership style that certainly Simon Sinek writes about in his book, Leaders Eat Last. Mm-hmm. Because that just drips and exudes, kind of the military leadership ethic,
right?
As I saw it in Naval right. Special Warfare.
Yeah, what I love about what you just said, and kind of what's coming to me now, is that there are certain characteristics or attributes or principles that make for great leadership across all domains, and then there's certain things that are really specific to different domains or unique to different domains. And so, for instance, what you're describing is small unit, naval special warfare, where there's a lot of autonomy, there's a lot of trust placed down, all the way to the lowest, the person closest to the sound of gunfire. All the officers / leaders are expected to, as we mentioned earlier at Buds, lead from the front and have competency across mm-hmm. all the basic skills so they can understand, so they can support the mission as a shooter as well, or an operator as well as an administrator or a coordinator. But, if you cross over and you're talking about leading an army, ranger regiment, those principles start to kind of not apply as much. And they have their own style that works for them, right? But there's certain things, like I said, that will cross the board. You got to have a vision, got to have a strong set of values, right? You got to be able to communicate effectively and whatnot. But then in the Army Rangers, like they're a little bit more top down, and the enlisted, you know, are going to be much more expecting to receive orders as opposed to in the SEALs figuring it out on the fly, right? Because they may not have time, or those orders might never come. You know, I'm reminded of examples of different SEAL leaders I've had on my podcast, and it always comes out that anytime they're in a joint operation, you know, especially guys who are like dev grew working with Rangers, for an example, the dev grew guy, you know, is just sitting there watching his platoon, you know, kind of like, and saying nothing, right? But being prepared if he sees something that's out of whack to, to insert, you know, his guidance or to provide some support. Whereas, you know, his Ranger counterpart, you know, the major or the lieutenant colonel is like directing every movement of his guys in the field. And how the Ranger would look at the SEAL and be like, how come you're not leading? And the SEAL would look at the Ranger and say, how come you're micromanaging the shit out of this thing?
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? I don't know.
I think the conventional forces, whether they be Army, Navy, Air Force, or Marines, there's a standard operating procedure for everything. And, you know, what I learned in Naval Special Warfare is there is no normal situation. So you can't have an SOP for every single thing. And that's where the collaborative problem solving, you know, comes into effect.
I think that's why the SEAL, you know, spec ops type leadership is so valuable right now for everybody in the world, or at least for everybody who's dealing with the VUCA, you know, corporations who are undergoing great change, everyone, government's undergoing great change. So it's a mindset that we've developed that happens to be particularly valuable now and probably in the foreseeable future.
I think you're right.
Yeah, I think I need to do a solo cast on that. That's coming up next. You got your PhD and you got it in like spec ops, low intensity conflict, right? What does the University of Oklahoma know about that? Like, why did you get it there?
Well, it was home. So, you know, when we came back home and Tony did a clerkship for Judge Bachrach. Mm-hmm. And it was my original plan. I retired and I spent a year, you know, as a contractor working for the Joint Special Operations University.
Right.
And I thought that was going to kind of be my trajectory. And I saw that, you know, folks that had a PhD, something beyond the master's degree, were making a whole lot more money. So I had the GI Bill and my thinking was, you know what, I'm just going to take a break. I'm going to go back to school. I'm going to knock out the PhD, which is an arrogant statement in and of itself. Oklahoma was, you know, the major university that was close. And so I started on that trajectory. Okay. With the idea that I would go back, you know, to work for the government in some capacity, back to JSAL. Right. That was the original plan.
JSAL is a great place. So what kind of took you off course?
Well, I think education changes people. And I became aware, you know, in Naval Special Warfare, you're surrounded by, you know, elite individuals, physically elite, mentally elite. They're always willing to roll up their sleeves. And I think I became aware, you know, being in the military, that military bubble where you've got base housing, you've got healthcare, mm-hmm. you know, you've got base Dodd schools, you know, for your kids. And I became aware for the first time that, you know, the rest of America is not necessarily like that. And so, you know, there was a lot of individuals, you know, young people joining Teach for America. What in the hell is Teach for America? And so I learned a little bit about its mission and I thought, oh my gosh, you know, here are these young people willing to jump into the buzzsaw that is, you know, the problem with inner city and public education and the achievement gap. Mm-hmm. And here I am drawing a full retirement. I'm secure. I've got a wife who's an attorney. This is something that I should do. I should be willing to roll up my sleeves and help solve this national problem. And, you know, so after a lot of talking with Tony, my wife, we decided that we could do that. And so I applied for Teach for America and got accepted and went off to Institute, which is their version of boot camp. It's about 2 months long. And I was starting to turn gray at the temples already. I was in my 40s, surrounded by all these very young, very idealistic individuals. And Teach for America said, okay, where would you like to go? And being the Navy guy, I said, well, wherever the greatest need is. Mm-hmm. And so, okay, great. We're going to send you to New Orleans, Louisiana. It was 2009. Right after Hurricane Katrina in 2010. So the city was still rebuilding.
Wow.
And what would you like to teach? Wherever the greatest need is. And so I wound up special education at an alternative school, which is where the student wow. population has been disengaged from employment and education due to incarceration, due to teen pregnancy, for any number of reasons. Some had been disengaged, you know, for, you know, 2 or 3 years after Hurricane Katrina, they just didn't go back to school. Mm-hmm. And so I did that for 3 years and then spent a year with the Department of Education, the state of Louisiana's Department of Education, working the truancy issue, mm-hmm. and then moved to DC with Teach for America's national staff. So I spent a total of 5 years with Teach for America.
Right.
If you include the classroom time and right. then the, you know, 3 years in the classroom, 1 year with the State Department of Education, and then 1 year as director of the Veterans Outreach Initiative, you know, with the idea of trying to recruit veterans
right.
to help solve this problem in public education.
That's terrific. So that's what led you to then kind of shift toward veterans education through the Warrior Project, I imagine.
Right. So Warrior Scholar Project was looking for a new executive director. I received a phone call and somebody said, you should check this out. And the phone call was actually from Chris Marvin, who at the time was the head of Got Your Six, mm-hmm. which is a veterans advocacy group, or was. And so I applied and got hired and spent 4 years, you know, back in the Beltway doing that, inside the Beltway. And Warrior Scholar Project is an academic boot camp for enlisted veterans who wanted to use the GI Bill and go back to school. Basically, it helps these individuals raise the bar in their own mind of what they can accomplish so that they don't have to settle for a school like the University of Phoenix. And they right. can, right. you know, they can apply to Yale and
so
Harvard.
You prep them both academically, also with support to know mm-hmm. what colleges to go for, how to apply to college, that type of stuff.
Yeah. So it started out at Yale and expanded to Harvard. And then right. by the time I left, we were at 17 campuses.
Nice. Well, that's interesting. I'm happy to have Vincero as a sponsor of today's podcast. I love partnering with Vincero. They're the premier manufacturer of men's and women's accessories, watches, sunglasses, bracelets, and wallets, and they're all available for under $200. Vincero knows just how important it is to look and feel your best, and they're here to help you feel good and look good wherever you go. My watches from Vincero are stylish, they're classy, and they're affordable. I love that they make everything in-house and they build it to last, and I love that they don't break the bank. They believe you deserve to look good no matter your budget. That's why Vincero is my go-to to look good and feel good, so I can be in Hollywood someday. Head over to VinceroCollective.com/unbeatable to check out their products and take advantage of our podcast special 15% off discount. Vincero is loved not just by me, but other favorite entrepreneurs, viewers, athletes, and podcast hosts. I love my Vincero watches. Seriously, I highly recommend them. They look great. And like I said, they understand the frustrations of online shopping. They get it. That's why they make it as easy as possible. Every purchase automatically comes with a 5-year warranty, 365-day return policy. Shopping online at Vincero.com is stress-free, and you're always going to get a great price. Check out VinceroCollective.com. That's VinceroCollective.com/unbeatable. Get that 15% off discount. They've got over 30,000 five-star reviews from verified customers. I think they're a great place to shop, and their team is in San Diego, right down the road from us. Always available if you need any help. Check it out, VinceroCollective.com/unbeatable. Hoo-yah. You know, before we started the podcast, you said, and this was a surprise to me, that 200,000 veterans are transitioning out every, did you say every year?
Every year, every month.
Every month?
Yeah, according to the Pentagon.
That doesn't even seem possible.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's the numbers based on the latest report, which is from 2018. But 200,000 a month, you know, and you've got these individuals that are coming back into society with a tremendous amount of attributes, you know, that have been honed during military service.
Right.
Team builders, they've got leadership skills, they've got technical skills. Mm-hmm. They're adaptable, they're diverse, they're able to make decisions under stressful conditions. And so you've got an ideal civic asset, you know, right there. And a lot of folks struggle with the transition out of military service to, you know, to come back into society. And right. We've got, fortunately, a lot of really strong veteran service organizations that help with that transition. You know,
that's so, relatively new though, right? Because when you and I transitioned, it was very little. I think they had one program.
Right. So the military program is TAPS, or Transition Assistance Program, which is still, I would argue, not all it could be.
Right.
There's been a lot of work to try to improve that, but you've got a lot of veterans nonprofits out there.
Yeah, they've popped up for the last 10 years. Honor Foundation is what kind of comes to me. That's a neat group that started with SEALs to help them. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of like the Warrior Scholar Project, but to gear them toward a job, you know, a
business
job, a business job. Yeah.
Yeah. Joe Musselman, you know, visionary, great guy.
Yeah. Yeah. I should do a podcast with Joe. He's a neat guy. And I, you know, he's now moved on. And I think the Honor Foundation has expanded to include, you know, all vets, or maybe all spec ops are starting there. Anyway, but a lot of the vets transitioning have seen a lot of combat. You know, we were talking about how 20 years of Afghanistan and Iraq literally meant that there's literally three generations of people who've experienced combat. There's the young, you know, Army, Marine, you know, Air Force or Navy enlisted or officer, you know, who might have done a tour or two and then gotten out, and they're like 26 or 27. Then there's the mid-career, you know, mm-hmm. person who, you know, maybe does three or four tours over there, who's 40 years old. And then there's, you know, there's the person who's in their late 50s or early 60s transitioning out as a senior officer or senior enlisted. So you literally have everywhere from 20 to 60 year old military vets having experienced, you know, sustained combat in very confusing and dangerous world. And so part of the issue with these 200,000 folks transitioning every month is post-traumatic stress.
Yeah, and interesting.
Not just positioning for careers and for college, but also healing, which is why the Courage Foundation, we started that. And, you know, I think about those numbers, like how like we've got to really expand that mission to be able to help a lot more folks, you know.
And interestingly, you don't have to have been in combat to suffer mm-hmm. from post-traumatic stress. I mean, there's a well-known study, Charles Fritz, 1961, actually determined that people in the rear that hadn't seen combat, and current you know, surveys reflect this, that they're actually more likely to suffer from PTS really? Than frontline units. And why is that? It's because crisis and adversity increases, you know, the bonding and increases resilience. Right. That's, you know, that's what the numbers are telling us. And so, you know, even though, you know, not every unit is engaged in combat in Iraq and Afghanistan, many of those, you know, who are in the service are going to come home and transition out with PTS.
That's amazing. And now we're also learning more about the micro trauma that could lead to long-term issues for brain health and anxiety and depressive, you know, issues just from shooting at the range or being involved in demolitions, or, you know, if you're on a ship and the big guns are going off, right? And the helicopters mm-hmm. and the jets landing. And so they're doing a lot more studies in it, you know, and I've talked to some doctors who work with spec ops, and they say that they don't think there's a single special operator who doesn't suffer from some form of TBI.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so, you know, I took that on board and ended up getting some of the, you know, the services of the Brain Treatment Center here in San Diego, just to make sure, because they said they may not, you know, for high performance like you and I, it doesn't really show up until, right, maybe when you're in your 80s, and then suddenly the cumulative effect of that TBI starts to wreak havoc. And you certainly saw that with football players, professional mm-hmm. football players, right? They're getting massive TBI. And if it's untreated, then you got these guys in their, you know, 60s with dementia, which is just really sad.
That's really good to know, because I know I spent way too much time at the range without my hearing protection.
Right. Yeah, something to pay attention to. If you're a vet listening to this.
Spongy ones.
Yeah, I remember that. It was woefully inadequate.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about, and we'll end here soon, but talk a little bit about your vision and mission, you know, now at the Courage Foundation, and, you know, what you hope to see, you know, what your vision for the future is, both for vets and, you know, for this country.
That's
a broad statement, but
first of all, very honored to have joined the Courage Foundation team and the Unbeatable Mind team. You know, I just, you know, that whole mantra of master yourself and serve others that you and I have talked about, that is the, you know, kind of the bumper sticker of what Unbeatable Mind is all about. And I'm just thrilled to be part of the serve others piece of that. But, you know, that right now we're focused on veterans because we're not very big, and we're going to have a lot of veterans that need support. But the vision, you know, going forward, is I would like to see Courage Foundation grow to include first responders. I mean, if you think about our Vietnam generation of veterans that came home and weren't really appreciated, you know, slurs, called baby killers, you know, hated, looked down upon because they had been drafted and had gone to Vietnam and served. And then a lot of that rhetoric, I would argue, hovers around our police officers today, you know, and there's nothing like having a job, a difficult job, and not feeling like you're appreciated by those that you're working to serve. Mm-hmm. That's tough. Some of our teachers, it's the same sort of thing in these really, really tough schools, you know, they just don't feel appreciated. And that, I think that manifests itself in the fact that most teachers in public education leave the profession before they hit the 5-year mark.
Really?
So there's a lot of room and there's a lot of good, I think, that the Courage Foundation can do going forward and growing and getting bigger and serving more people.
I agree. Yeah, my original vision was more expansive, but then it was difficult to kind of raise money for some of the issues. You know, I was mm-hmm. trying to support some of the prison population and help them heal and find purpose again, and also battered women. But yeah, so we ended up collapsing it to really veteran issues to kind of get a foothold and to you know, make a difference, at least in one place. You know, kind of focus precedes success, right? So
yeah, I mean, you're driven by resources. So I think that was, you know, absolutely the, you know, the right call, you know, focus on veterans nowadays, not the case during the Vietnam years, but nowadays, you know, everybody appreciates military veterans.
Yeah. You know, I think I'd like to end with a question I often ask people. You know, when you listen to the news and you talk to people, you know, it seems to be kind of a gloomy, very pessimistic outlook on the world and where our country is going and, you know, how things look like. People think that, you know, we're basically going to be consumed with, you know, global warming, or, you know, jihad's going to sweep across, or we're all going to end up, you know, as communists. You know, it's like, what is your view of the future? What's your vision?
Well, it's a positive vision, but I think it's, you know, a couple of things. I think as humans, we're naturally prone to cognitive dissonance. In other words, we like to hear things that we agree with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to piggyback on Robert Putnam's work, Bowling, and his book, Bowling Alone, we don't interact as well anymore. His book, Bowling Alone, basically is the bowling leagues have fallen apart. And that's where people, you know, interacted socially and shared stories. And it was easier to disagree, but remain friends. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, you know, with social media and people being much, much more isolated, It's easy to only listen or only seek out the point of view that you agree with. And I think that only adds to the disparity in viewpoints and the polarization, you know, that we have in this country. But I'm an optimist. I don't think that we're Rome. I don't think we're falling apart. And I don't think that America is doomed or that the world is doomed. I think people are strong, people are resilient, and you know, we'll get past some of this. I you know, and I think too, Watergate taught our press that you know, the sensational story is the one that sells, and so you've got to uncover the big scandal. Right. And so a lot of journalists are running around looking for a scandal and then blowing it up real big. And then that just gets people that much more agitated.
Yeah. And it's led to kind of a jaded approach toward media, you know, and even I fell into that. Like, I don't trust anything coming out of mainstream media anymore. I call it opposite day. I try to look at what the story is. And then I think, well, what's the exact opposite? And I said, that's probably closer to the truth.
Yeah. Or just go outside and look around. And
right. Oh, I just spent 7 days in Wyoming just staring at the most incredible landscape. Just stunning, you know. And that was like reading the positive newspaper, hanging out with the horses and the ranch hands. So I'm with you. I'm optimistic about the future. I'm super stoked to have had this conversation, Sid. I really appreciate it. Where can people learn more about your work with the Courage Foundation or anything else you want to share?
Well, we've got a major campaign we're working on, and we'll be rolling it out. It's Burpees for Vets.
Nice.
And
that sends shivers up my spine, by the way, because we're doing 120,000 burpees in 2019.
We're bringing that back to life. And you know, we're going to collaborate with other veteran service organizations, and it'll be a month-long campaign. And we've got some great connections that we're making with the NFL, with large organizations, as well as veteran service organizations. So we're hoping it'll be very, very successful. The idea is, you know, you do the burpees and challenge three friends and make a small donation and challenge three friends. And we're hoping that it gains the same momentum that that the Ice Bucket Challenge did.
Sweet.
And gets more people involved.
That's coming up in October?
It'll be November.
November?
The month of November.
It's straddling Veterans Day.
Yeah.
Terrific. And so is it still the burpeesforvets.com website, or that you want people to go to learn about this, or where would they learn more?
Well, we're going to tweak and launch the website. But yeah, it'll be burpeesforvets.com, and the hashtag is #burpeesforvets. The idea is to bring together nonprofit organizations that serve veterans in the physical fitness realm, in the mental health realm, and then just in general transition. So your education facing veterans, nonprofits, right, and the like.
And if a listener is part of an organization like that or wants to donate or learn more, how would they connect with you?
It would be Sid@feedcourage.org.
Feedcourage.org.
Or you can send me a text message. My cell phone is area code 504-281-0479. But I'd love to hear from you and connect with you and set up a Zoom call.
Awesome. Awesome, Sid. Well, thanks again for your service, both in the military and now serving our vets at the Courage Foundation. And I appreciate you. And insights on leadership are invaluable. So,
thank you, Mark. Thanks for having me. And I've really enjoyed this past hour.
Yeah, appreciate it. Me too.
Take care.
All right, folks. That was retired Commander Sid Ellington, Dr. Sid. Although, you know, Sid, you know, I'm going back to get my doctorate, and I'm not doing it because I want people to call me doctor. And I notice you don't lead with that either. Like, you don't like it, probably.
Well, as soon as I got that sheepskin, I put it on my LinkedIn page, but it's way down now.
It's down below.
It's not the leading headline.
Do it for the education, not for the title. Well, I appreciate you. All right, folks, that's it. So check out the Courage Foundation at feedcourage.org. Send Sid an email if you want to connect with him at sid@feedcourage.org. Or he was bold enough to put his cell phone out there. So go ahead and send him a text message. And thanks again for your support. You can check out our work at Unbeatable Mind at unbeatablemind.com. We have a phenomenal new 30-day course, which is a great way to get introduced to our principles. That's unbeatablemind.com/challenge. Check that out. And until next time, stay focused and be unbeatable. This is Mark Divine out here. Hoo-yah.